Thanks, everybody. Hey, my name is Devin. I am a recovered alcoholic. I'm actually more rested than I've been the last two times, so I'm really excited to be here. I actually got to sleep this weekend. It's really great. I do have a sobriety date. It's August 28th of 2011. I have a home group, which is called No Serenity Till Brooklyn, and I do consider myself a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess, so there's a few people that maybe haven't been here the last couple of weeks, so I'll try to do like the briefest recap of what we've been talking about. And I actually have a lot that I was hoping to cover today, so we'll see how far we actually get. But, you know, the first week we were here, I tried to really just talk about the problem. And then last week we kind of talked about the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous brings to the table, being that I need to have a God in my life. And the unfortunate reality that for a lot of us, we come in and we really fight that that's the answer to alcoholism, that that would be the simplicity of, oh, I need to seek a relationship with some kind of power in my life, that I don't really like that. I didn't know what alcoholism was until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, actually a few years. Nobody had really cracked open the big book or read the doctor's opinion with me in a pointed fashion where we really broke it down and looked at what was being said. And today when I claim that I'm an alcoholic, you know, I really do mean the totality of what I understand alcoholism to be, which is a threefold illness. Alcoholism shows up in my life physically, mentally, and spiritually. And how it shows up physically is once I've started drinking, I can't seem to control what's going to happen every time. Maybe sometimes I can, but there's also nights and days where I don't know what's going to happen. And I have a decision where I make a decision that I'm going to go out and have a few drinks, and then, you know, a week later I've been on a bender and I don't know what happened. You know, I realized I'd been abstinent at 18. I'd been put in a treatment center by my family. I was an IV drug user at that point. They had found out it was really hairy, and they said, "You got to go get help." And I said, "I'm fine." But I had to go to this treatment thing, and I had almost 90 days of like forced sobriety in my life. And the first night that I was out, I was offered a drink. I took that drink, and I went on a bender that was about 6 years long. You know, and so I offer that, you know, if you've had experience where you've been separated from alcohol at one point, and then you find yourself here, I would invite you to look at the totality of your drinking and see how's it really been going. Because if you're like me, you end up getting to this really dark place where you have to drink. And maybe you're physically dependent on that. Like we get the shakes, we get the sweats, we have physical symptoms that do show up if we've been abusing alcohol to that level. And I would always get there. I would hit a wall. I would feel this internal, like, oh my God moment. Something's got to change. And I would try to change my life. And there was times where I was able to change my life for seemingly an extended period of time. In the beginning, it might have been like 6 months. Kind of manageable, kind of like not screwing up too much, you know, having a few days where I can kind of handle life, and then I would have the party, and then eventually that would kind of shrink as far as how I could manage it, and then by the end I'd be back to I need to have a drink all day every day. And I noticed that when I would come to my senses and try to manage my life on that 6 year timeline, the amount of time that I could actually manage my consumption of drinking and my lifestyle and how I was feeling was getting shorter and shorter, and the amount of times that I needed to be drinking the clock around was getting longer and longer. And so that's why today when I look at it, I really understand that from the moment I took a drink until the moment I was struck sober was almost 6 years to the day, and it was like one long bender. And you know, and one of the reasons why it was such a long bender was because alcoholism shows up for me in my mind. Our book says that the main problem of the alcoholic actually centers in our mind rather than our body. And I think we've talked about it a couple of times where if the alcohol is the problem, then I just don't drink and then I don't have a problem. But I don't know about you guys. If I stop drinking and I'm sober and I'm living as I was always living, sober, without a drink, I don't get better, I get worse. There's something else that's going on where life is not getting easier. I'm not happy. I seem to be able to not control how I'm feeling. You know, I have mood swings. I get really angry. Fear creeps in and I don't know what to do and I get afraid. And eventually, on any long enough timeline, if I don't have some kind of different solution in my life than alcohol, I eventually start drinking again. And I forget about those days where I couldn't stop. And I forget about the consequences. All that stuff just goes on the back burner. I don't even consider it And there's a moment where the only thing I can do is I have to take a drink, and I do. And then I kick the whole thing off again. So that's a bigger problem, and that's why in that 6 years I think I had these moments where I hit the wall, I try to manage my life, and I manage for a little bit, and then my mind kind of seems to conveniently forget, or has an inability, as our book suggests, to bring back into my conscious thought the pain and the suffering and the humiliation of what's been going on when I'm drinking in those moments where I can't stop myself and I'm blacking out almost every night. And I'm being driven to wake up in the morning and go buy a 40 first thing out the gate. So I didn't know that that's how alcoholism might show up in my life. I met some people that were recovered alcoholics, and they put some questions in front of me. They said, have you been able to stay stopped? Have you ever been able to make a decision to quit and actually follow that through? And I was like, well, no. I mean, I came to you guys. I came to AA. I came to a church basement because obviously I felt like something was not working. And I didn't have a religion, I didn't have a faith, I didn't have really spiritual practices. I was aware of Alcoholics Anonymous from that treatment center. I had one guy in my life who said, I go to AA and it works for me. And he was like the happy guy that I hated, because I hated everybody. And I was like miserable with this dark cloud around, you know, walking around just like looking at everybody, judging you, just like spiteful. And so I had some people that pointed me that AA was maybe an option. But I didn't understand alcoholism at all. And so I can't stay stopped is a really great question. You know, have you ever made a plan for your drinking and failed? You know, how many times I set up the parameters of this is how much I can drink, and I put in like, oh, I'm going to be able to get wasted Friday, Saturday. That's great. I build in the nights where I can go get hammered. And then 2 weeks into the plan, it's out the window, and I'm just getting hammered all day, every day. You know, what's going on there? And then the other question of, you know, which I laughed at, is like, can you control how much you drink every time? And it's like, well, dude, if I had to control it, I'm not enjoying it. And I'm here to enjoy my drinking if I can. And ultimately, at the end, there was no enjoyment in it, because what's happening when I'm getting drunk is it's all just misery. You know, in the beginning, alcohol wiped away my fear. It wiped away my insecurities. It allowed me to feel bigger and stronger and better. And I could go out and I could talk to her and I could meet people and I could be okay in my own skin. And by the end of it, everybody's asking me to leave because I'm incapacitated on the couch. And people think I might die over there. And I'm alone. And I'm miserable. And it's dark. And I've got nothing to live for, and I have no joy in my life. So that's a problem. And I would say that, you know, the reason for me that my mind does that is because in the beginning, alcohol did work. You know, it did solve my sobriety problem, which is that when I'm sober, I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. I don't know how to be, and I don't know how to act. And I have an ability to look at everybody in the world, and I assume that you guys are fine. You know, you've got clean clothes on, you're smiling, you got the car, whatever. I assume that your life must just be perfect. Aren't they just perfect? You know, and I get really angry at that. But it's all me. I've just made the decision that you've got no problems because I want to have no problems. And that's what I think is ideal in life, is to just feel great all the time. And so I walk around with this spiritual problem that I'm less than, and I feel insignificant, and I feel broken and like I'm damaged goods. And that's really what I think drives my mind to obsess about alcohol, is because those first couple of times early on when I did experience what alcohol could do for a guy like me, it crossed a bunch of wires instantly. And so I didn't understand that alcoholism was this threefold illness. I also didn't understand that our solution in AA was that you're going to have a relationship with the God of your own understanding. And last week, I think we talked about some of the what I found is like helpful suggestions in the chapter to the agnostic in the big book. You know, they offer up a bunch of analogies and they say, you know, what is this faith business? Haven't you had faith before? No, I've never had faith before. Well, what about alcohol? Didn't you have faith in alcohol? Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I knew if I take four drinks that it was going to work. Well, that's faith. You know, and so they bring up all these problems. They go, well, how often, you know, it's like you have a cell phone, right? Do you know how 5G works? Do you know how this thing actually touches the satellite and connects you to the thing and you can call people across the planet? No. How do you know it works? Well, I pick up the phone, I push Jim, and Jim and I are talking in my car. I just assume that because I have proof that it's actually worked, that it works. But someone's told me that this works. And then I experience it working and I just say, that's fact now. But when I come in and I'm told that the God idea works on alcoholism, I want to argue with that. Because I bring to that discussion all of my prejudices that I walked in the door with. And they talk about, perhaps we bring in the belief of our family members. You know, maybe I bring in my parents' beliefs and that doesn't work for me. Or I bring in the church that I was raised in's beliefs and that doesn't work for me. Or maybe I bring up the, you know, my friends that have instilled other ideas about religion and spirituality. Maybe I bring those to the table. Maybe those don't work for me. And AA suggests that I should ask questions about what would work for me. And maybe better yet, what won't work for me. And the cool thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is there's no AA God. You know, and in fact, we say you got to have your own personal experience so that you have a God of your understanding. And that if I say God, or anybody says, well, the answer is God, that you guys get to not have to consider my conception of that, but ask yourself what would work for you. And so when I say that word, I hope that you're channeling that. You know, some people, that word brings up a whole lot of stuff. There's vitriol. We bristle with antagonism. It's what our literature says. And so I would offer that, you know, I was working with this lady and she needed to use the word like Jedi or something. She's like, for me, it's like Jedi and like ninja warrior thing. And I was like, awesome. When I say God, you think Jedi. Can we get on that page? Because if it works for you, that's what we want to find. If it doesn't work for you, then throw it away. And so these first 2 weeks, I wanted to spend a lot of time talking about that. And we joked that the name of the workshop was going to be Our Shared Dilemma. And the joke is that our shared dilemma is not just that we have alcoholism, but is also that maybe the solution to alcoholism being a spiritual one in nature is also a problem for me. And what I found is it's really simple stuff. And so today I kind of wanted to talk about the simplicity of what living this way of life kind of looks like. And when we're new, we have this whole mountain. We're looking at all these steps, and we might think I have to do all this stuff right now. And the good news is they're in order for a reason, is that if I'm willing to have an open mind and try to come to believe that there's a power greater than myself, the only reason I came to do that was I realized how screwed I was. I really understood I was powerless. You know, mind, body, and spirit, I am powerless to change me. And that was the day I got struck sober, was the day I raised my hand and said, I know I'm going to drink and be high later unless I'm surrounded by you people. I said, I'm screwed and I don't know what to do. You know, and it was like the first time I ever touched my truth, which was the best I can do is get loaded. That's the best I can do. And that doesn't make me a bad person, it makes me a sick person. And that was how I came to be, you know, I came to be open to Alcoholics Anonymous because I met you guys. And I met people that were saying that they were sober, and they attributed their sobriety to the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in this fellowship. And I said, well, that's weird, because I don't really know much about any of that stuff. But I'd meet all these like smiling people at the meeting, and they'd be really excited to meet me, and they would say, hey, you don't have to drink ever again. You can actually go out and have a useful, happy, contented life if you're willing to get on board with this program. But I also didn't understand that the fellowship is different than the program. And I don't know if we talked about that as much, but the fellowship is like this. The meetings, going out to the diner, making phone calls to other people that are sober. That's the community and the camaraderie that I must have because I need you guys. But the program is our 12 steps. You know, and how often do we hear people come into meetings and they say, I've been in and out of the program for 20 years. And you go, well, how far have you gotten through the steps? Oh, I started my fourth step a few times. You know, and to that I might offer that maybe you've just been in the fellowship for 20 years. You know, and we do have a program. And that program means I gotta do some stuff. And I got to be willing to face me. And that's I think that's the most difficult thing for any of us to do. And so, at the end of, on page 60, if you look at, there's that passage, How It Works. Now, a lot of us, we go to meetings, you hear How It Works is read. And, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail. And if you're like me, you might check out until they get to the end and they read this A, B's, and C's, because I've heard it so many times. But I want to read what this A, B, and C stuff is, because this is kind of what I think I spent the last 2 weeks talking about. So this is 60 pages and some forewords and some Roman numerals in. So we're probably closer to like 80 pages in. I don't know how much the Roman numerals really are, but I think we get into like 20, I don't know, we're like 85, 88 pages in. And it says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. So up to this point, everything in this book has been designed to make clear these three ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Is what I was just kind of talking about. Is that clear to me? If I've read the book up to this point, is that clear to me? B, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. You know, the question I always ask is, what did you try? I love human power. I love money and women and cars, or, you know, all the crap that we buy. You know, I had a bunch of shoes at one point. I owned a bunch of hats, and I bought a bunch of drums, and I got tattoos. You know, I can spend money with the best of them. You know, you give me a budget, I'll blow that thing really quick, right? That's human power. I've thrown that at my alcoholism for years. It's never scratched even the surface of this spiritual illness that I know to be alcoholism. You know, I got into relationships, and you could look at physical intimacy. That's power. You know, there's a dynamic going on there. There's something that I'm getting out of that, affection and attention and validation from another person. Well, that always seems to fall short too. You know, eventually I wake up and I look at her and I go, well, it's the same person again, and it's not doing it for me, and so I go and I drink. You know, so I tried a lot of human power. Coming to the fellowship, sitting around in AA meetings, talking to people, making phone calls. That's human power. While we do experience God consciousness in a meeting, ultimately that's not going to be the same as when I have a real relationship with a God of my understanding. I remember I was 13 days sober, and I had scheduled a trip to go to my family in outside of Chicago at the time, because I couldn't stop, and I was like really freaking out. I've been going to AA meetings for like 3 months, and I just couldn't stop. And so I was like, I guess I need to get separated from New York for a minute. So I scheduled a couple of days or a week to see the family, and I was going to try to detox, like unknowingly detox with my parents' house. And I got on the plane, I was 13 days sober, and they started passing a cart down the middle. And they said, hey, if anyone wants to buy, you know, we got the little shooters, we got some wine, you know, we got some beer. And I was sitting there going, man, every time I'm at a meeting, they say, if you're in a place and they're serving alcohol, leave. I'm 30,000 feet up in the air. How am I supposed to leave? They say, pick up the phone and call me. I go, man, this is 2010 or 11. There wasn't, you know, the service and Wi-Fi on all the planes. I can't make a phone call. You know, it was the first time I realized that there might be a moment in my life where I don't have access to you at all. There might be a moment in my life where I call 7 or 8 people in AA and it's 2 a.m. and everyone's asleep. And I'm going to be left with, do I have a God or not? You know, and so I got to understand that, like, human power works to a point. But if that's the only power I'm running on, that's going to run out. And there will be a situation presented in my life that if I don't have some kind of spiritual power that I'm hooked up to, that I will start again. Because I'm powerless. So what human powers did I try? Did it ever work? I would offer that if it worked, we're probably not in an AA meeting. You know, if I could have fixed my alcoholism before coming to AA, I think I would have. I think we all would have. You know, I don't think anybody's in here going like, well, my life's pretty great. I have a drinking problem, but it's pretty awesome. You know, maybe this AA thing. That sounds like it'd be fun. Yeah, I'll go for a Sunday evening. It'd be great. Hang out with some people, meet some folks. I don't know anybody like that. I know we come in and it's like, dude, I'm so mangled that I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it's like there's this stigma, and we think, oh, God, alcoholic is a dirty word. I can't be an alcoholic. You know, we have all these things. Like, this is horrible that I would end up here. So, the last thing that I got to be convinced of is that God could and would if He were sought. And in my book, I have the word sought circled. There's some action here. It's not that God can and will. They're like, oh, one day God's just going to show up and strike me sober. I need to do the seeking. The seeking is on me. Now, I will offer, the day that I got struck sober, I did not think that I was seeking God. However, when I look back on it today with a little bit of a different perspective, I understand that if I'm new and I'm hurting, coming to a meeting is a form of prayer. Whenever we come together and we say, you know, I need to be in a meeting, and I show up here and I make it part of my life to be with you guys, I am saying a prayer. What I'm saying is I need help. Because if I could do this alone, I wouldn't trek out to Jersey for a couple hours round trip on a Sunday evening. I would just stay at home where it's comfortable and, you know, wait for my wife to get home from her trip and hang out in the AC, you know, do whatever I want to do. And today I want to be here with you guys. But in the beginning it was like, I don't want to talk to you guys. I got my friends, thank you very much. I'm not interested in a social circle, I got that. but I need help. So coming to a meeting can be considered a form of prayer. Raising my hand and saying, I need help. Calling another alcoholic. Asking somebody, will you show me these steps? Those are prayers. You know, in the beginning, I think that's how we come to believe. Is I start asking for some help and then I'm open to receiving the direction that's offered. The next step, or the next sentence rather, on page 60 says, being convinced, we were at step 3. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about sponsorship today, but the book kind of qualifies when I'm at the third step. It says, if I'm convinced that I'm alcoholic and can't manage my own life, that I'm convinced that there's no human power available to me that's going to fix my alcoholism, and I'm open to the idea that if I seek a relationship with God, that He can and will remove this obsession to drink, that I'm at step 3. I have met people on their first day in AA, at their first meeting, that were at step 3. We had a conversation. We talked about all this stuff. I asked these questions. In about an hour and a half, 2 hours, we ascertained that they were able to answer in the affirmative to all these things. And we got to looking at the third step, which says that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understand Him. And then I love how Bill starts to write. So at this page 60. Now from page 60 to page 89, 29 pages here, they have the entirety of the directions from our third step through to our 11th step. And then they have an entire chapter about working with others and sponsorship, and then they go in to talk about, you know, the family and maybe our job situation, and they give us this love letter called A Vision for You, where they kind of spell out, here's what your life might look like if you're willing to go out and do what we've been doing. So in 29 pages, we get to learn kind of like the directions of everything I need to know about how I'm going to help somebody, but also what I need to do for myself, which I think is really cool that it's this condensed. And the way Bill starts writing it, as he says, you're now at step 3 if you can admit these things. And then he asks the question, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? And now he's going to tell us. Early on in the book, it says clear-cut directions showing how we have recovered from alcoholism will be detailed in the pages in this book. And here's where we start to get it. If you're new and you look at page 60, you'll notice that we were at step 3 is in italics. And from here until page 89, every time we get to another step, it's in italics, which is like a way for me to understand that from this part of step 3 until it gives me the italics of when I'm at step 4, this is like all the stuff I need to understand and maybe the directions I need to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God. So I'm going to not read all of this and do like the big book study thing where we go line by line, because I think we should get to a little bit more today. But I would offer that what they start to bring up here is I come into AA and I think I have a drinking problem. You guys say it's not a drinking problem, it's a thinking problem. Because if it was a drinking problem, you don't drink, you don't have a problem. So the fact that you keep thinking yourself back into a drink, that's a problem. And I say, okay. So now I'm convinced that I'm powerless over alcohol, and I'm convinced that I can't seem to manage my life. And you guys say, the reason you can't manage your life is that you have lack of power. So my problem is I got lack of power. And then I come into here, and at the top of page 62, it says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And now I'm confronted with the real problem, is that I'm a completely self-centered and selfish individual. And I love that they talk about how selfishness is the root of my troubles. Now, I'm not super into like understanding how plants work, but I do understand how the roots of a tree work. And if you go outside and we look at the trees, where are the roots? They're in the ground. I don't see the root. What I see is the trunk and then the branches and the leaves. So what I understand about that is the trunk might be lack of power. And stemming off the trunk onto these branches, well, that's the mental obsession that I can't shake. You know, that's the, once I start drinking, I can't control how much I'm drinking. Those are like the branches. You know, and if I try to address why I think this way and I try to address why I drink this way, I'm just kind of like, you ever see when they come and prune trees? They come and they lop off some branches, then they grow back. If you're going to kill a tree, you got to take it all the way out and you got to remove the roots. And so what they talk about in this third step and what Bill and these early, you know, 40, 50 people that were involved in editing and contributing to what we have in the big book, they bring to our attention that it's my selfishness and self-centeredness that's been the problem all along. And if you're like me and you're defiant, I don't really appreciate being told that I'm the problem. You know, you've always been the problem. You know, if I had more money, if you didn't screw me over, if I didn't get fired from that job, you know, and we all have a laundry list usually when we're new in sobriety about the ways in which the world has screwed us. A lot of us come in here and we're wounded and we're damaged because as kids we were abused by someone in our family or close friends. You know, we all come in with a lot of stuff and we usually have a lot of ammunition to blame the world. And from a moral standpoint, a lot of us are justified in those feelings. But the problem is for us, it's going to kill us to stay there. There might be some people in the world that can point the finger at everybody else forever and they're still okay. But what I've learned about me and my alcoholism is I don't have that luxury to do that because that'll kill me. So what does it mean to be selfish and self-centered and what does that look like? The book offers that if I'm selfish and self-centered, I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Now, I don't know about you guys. I got arrested only once. No, I've been in a cop car a couple times. But when I got arrested, they put the bracelets on, and I'm in the cop car, and not once did they ask me where I wanted to go. They didn't look back and say, "You hungry? We got a Burger King on the way. You want a Chick-fil-A? Any, you know, we get a sandwich?" They just put me in the car, and they drove. That's being driven. You know, I don't have a say in the matter if I'm being driven. And so what they're offering is that if I'm here and I'm alcoholic and I can't manage my life, perhaps what it looks like is that I'm being driven by 100 forms of fear, by self-delusion, by self-seeking and self-pity. That perhaps those attributes of my character are what are making my decisions for me, rather than me actually having the free will to make my own decisions. I think that I'm telling you off because of X, Y, Z, but really what fear is making that decision for me. Because I'm afraid that if, you know, my boss comes in and dumps a bunch of work on my plate and I won't be able to do it, then I'm going to get fired. So I react in some other way and, you know, yell at my subordinates or whatever it is. You know, how do I pass the buck in life is usually dependent upon a lot of fear. You know, self-delusion, they just talked about an analogy that most of us are out there trying to manage and control everybody and everything around us. And the delusion is that I have that kind of power, that I could really change who you are. That I could go out into this world and actually control how you live life. So I don't have an ability to do that, but I walk around thinking I have that kind of power. I walk around thinking that I'm bigger than and more important than maybe other people. And if I'm living life by that, that's maybe one of the reasons why life seems to be really difficult. You know, self-seeking. I'm trying to grab from everybody. You know, and I would tell myself the idea that I'm trying to set up a world in which your life goes well too. So it's like, dude, look, I'm not trying to screw you over. It'll be great for you if you just do everything that I'm telling you to do. Like, I'm not intentionally out there trying to maliciously hurt you. It's going to go well for you also, but I'm going to get all this added benefit as well. So just do what I'm saying and it'll work out for you too. And when they don't do that, I get angry, right? You know, and self-pity is I'm playing the victim in my life. You know, and I think beyond resentment, which this book considers to be the number one thing that's going to take alcoholics out, I think self-pity is a really close second that kills more alcoholics than anything else. You know, my great-grandsponsor would say it's the battle cry of where's mine? You know, and I look out at everybody else and I think that you've got it shinier and better and prettier and your life's, you know, more sparkly than mine. And I look at what I've got and it just isn't enough. It's just never enough. We were talking about, my buddy Jim and I were talking about this insatiable need for more. And we see it everywhere in society. I mean, it's like you can't, today with all the targeting of ads, I mean, you open a screen and you're like getting bombarded with like, the last three pages you looked at were suggesting that you'd like to buy this kind of soap. You're like, well, what? You know, like I'm being constantly like catered to buy more stuff. That like, well, you need to buy some stuff. And I constantly need more and more and more. And so self-pity can show up like life has just been, you know, I got really the bad, like crap end of the stick here. Where am I going to get that break? It just sucks. And in that place, I don't have any gratitude. Right? I'm not looking at the beauty of life. I'm just looking at what I don't have and what I think I need to have and what I deserve to have. And my pride gets kicked off and my jealousy gets kicked off. And it really gets really gross really fast if you're like me. And so I can't live in a world where that's what's driving the boat. And at the bottom of page 62, it says, Well, again, it says most of us have tried to have moral and philosophical convictions galore. We've tried to be good people. We tell ourselves we're good people. We want to be a good person, whatever you define good as, right? Like, I don't want to be hurting people. I want to be out there living in the world free and useful. But I don't have the ability to live up to those ideas. I just can't. I got to have God's help. And so they give us the directions of our third step, which I think, as I've been here longer, all these steps have changed over time. My first third step was my sponsor looked at me and said, you know, when I was going through the big book, he said, are you willing to make a decision to live and do the rest of these steps? That's really easy. If you're new here and you're not sure what this making a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand them peace is, I would offer that what you're really saying is, I'm going to make a decision to take the guidance of a sponsor who's showing me these steps. I'm going to actively pursue them and do what is asked of me. And I'm going to see this process through all the way until I'm reaching my hand out and trying to help some other people. You know, that would be how you could really make a decision to turn your thoughts and your actions over to a higher power. You know, you're essentially turning it over to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which today seems to have worked for, not seems to, it has worked for millions and millions of people all across the globe. And so that was my initial third step. It's just to make a decision and keep moving. But as I've been here a little longer, it was pointed out to me by my current sponsor that it maybe goes a little deeper. And what they say here is, first of all, we had to quit playing God. So how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? Is I have to stop thinking I'm God. It says, next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are His agents. He is the Father. We are His children. So if I think about the principal and agents, like my friend Anthony is becoming a pretty huge movie star. He's like coming up in like some crazy huge blockbuster movie. He's in like one of these, you know, the lead in a movie that just came out that's like super huge, and he's blowing up. He's the principal, but he has an agent. And what is his agent doing? Is doing all the work to make sure he gets those jobs, that he gets the money he's deserved, that all that stuff works out. They sort of schedule out all that stuff. So what they're offering is, if I can't play God, then I need to take the position that God is in charge. And that I am here to serve at the privilege of this God idea. Now, I don't like that. I especially don't like it when I'm new. But that, I also don't know what that means when I'm new, right? As I've been here a little longer, I've had to surrender more and more and more and more and more. And I think that this idea has now pervaded into my daily living. If I wake up and I go, I don't know what to do, I don't know what you need me to do, but if you'll show me, I'm willing to show up. And I'm willing to try to live as you intended for me today. It says, most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone to the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. If you've ever seen an arch, there's one block at the center. And it's the centering block, and it's got two, like, I guess it's concave angles. So it kind of like sits, and it balances the weight of all the other blocks that go down to the floor. That's the keystone. It's the central block that balances everything. And what they say here is, the idea that I am not God is going to be the central balancing idea and fact of my life if I'm willing to jump in. They give us some wonderful promises, and they say, if you're willing to live this way of life, you're going to get everything you need. You'll feel a new sense of peace and ease flow into you. You'll realize that God's kind of been there. They say you will become conscious of God's presence. So I think it's funny, they don't say you're going to find God. But they say you're going to actually realize that God's been there all along. Which is kind of amazing. And I will say that getting provided what I need is not always what I want. And this last year has really been evidenced of that. You know, I made a living touring the world, playing music, playing on Broadway, playing tons of different stuff with tons of different people. I never had a real job, really, in the last 10 plus years of living in New York City and being struck sober. I was able to make a living playing an instrument. And it's not lost on me that that's a very, very like small group of people that ever get to say that. And then this last year, I've been relegated. You see how I even put it? I've been relegated. I've been given a job and given money, been able to pay all my bills. I've gotten everything I've needed. I've had food. I've got a car that's a new car that I have to, I make the payments on, and I have enough gas to make it out here from Brooklyn to see you guys. Everything I've needed has been provided for me. But even when I go to talk about it, and I say relegated, you can tell that I'm not happy about it. It's not my plan. And I don't know where it ends. The last couple of days I've been getting up and I've been getting quiet and I said, God, it hurts. And I have a lot of fear that I'm going to be stuck in this kind of a position. And I cry in the meditation because I don't know where this is going. But I do feel the chills go down my spine and I feel that there's something that I'm connected to. And I feel that I'm where I need to be, because where I really need to be is seeking that relationship. Regardless of what out here looks like, if I'm seeking that relationship and I'm trying to cultivate that, I'm okay. Now, I get cranky. It's cranky the last couple of days, or Monday and Tuesday. I saw you guys. I was feeling good after I saw you guys. And I was just cranky for 48 hours or so. I don't know why. I woke up Wednesday and I was like, wow, I'm not cranky today. But that happens, right? Because my ideas of who I'm supposed to be and how I want to manage my life are not always in line with what God seems to have planned for me. So that's a bigger idea. Am I really willing to get on board with that every day? That's kind of tough. Some days I wake up and I've got a plan and I just want to get into life and do what I need to do, man. And sometimes I do. And it doesn't always go great. So thankfully we have some other steps later on that say, check how you're doing at the end of the night. See how you did. But I want to talk about this prayer. In the middle of 63, we get the third step prayer. That's what a lot of people fondly call it. Now, I'm going to read this first. There's amazing drunk bait and switch moments in the writing of this. They give you the prayer, and then after they read the prayer, they say, we thought well before taking this step. But they just gave you the prayer. So if you're reading it, you maybe just took the prayer by reading it, and now they're saying, think well before you take this step. But they also say this: it is better to meet God alone than with someone who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Now, I will tell you that on my sobriety date, when I raised my hand and said, I'm effed and I don't know what to do, but if I'm not surrounded by you people, I will be drunk and high tonight. It's going to happen. And we circled up and said the serenity prayer, and I got the chills down my spine. And I just said, this is for me. And I made a decision that whatever was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous was for me. I felt a very great effect. Doesn't look anything like what you would discuss in a big book and big book sponsorship. We're going to get you in. We're going to go through this. But that was my first third step experience. I just said whatever's going on in AA is for me. I had a tangible reaction. And from then until now, I've been continuously sober when I was blacking out almost every single night. It's a pretty great effect. But it wasn't the depth of what I have today, right? It was just what got me in the door, what got me going to meetings, what got me connected with the fellowship, connected with you guys, and got me open to seeking, really learning what's going on here. When I was 19, I was struggling. And I was in school, in this music school in Boston, and there was this drummer there. And there's a handful of really established jazz musicians that are members of a certain type of Buddhism where they chant. Some of you guys might be familiar. They're chanting these syllables, right? And so I had the great idea that I'd just gotten two home invasions from selling drugs, and I'd gotten my face smashed up with brass knuckles, and I gotta live different, man. And I was like, oh, Kenwood, he's doing this Buddhism thing. Maybe I should see what that's all about. And I was like, here's the answer. I'm gonna get in with the teachers that are in the great jazz musicians that do this thing, and I'm gonna be a Buddhist. That's the answer. And so I went, and he took me to this massive mega temple thing, and everyone's smiling, and they're like, you got to buy this thing called a Gohunzen, and I get the altar and the incense and a little prayer book and the beads and the whole thing. And I come out of there, and I'm carrying all this crap. And I'm like, all right, man. They're like, okay, here's what you do. You set the altar up, you open it up, you're going to light the incense, you're going to ring the bell, and then you sit and you pray this prayer book. You read this book. And we do that twice a day. Okay. And so I went and I started doing that. Now, it lasted maybe, I would say generously, if I called it 2 weeks, that would be really generous. It might have been 7 to 10 days. And I remember very clearly, I had the moment where I woke up and I said, this is a load of crap. And I just threw the stuff in my closet, and that was the end of it. Now, I will offer that that's not a load of crap, and it's helped a whole lot of people. But what didn't happen to me, or for me, and I don't think it's anyone's fault, was no one explained to me the essence of the prayer that I was reading. I sat there and I had the whole thing. And it was hollow because it was just meaningless syllables that didn't connect with anything that I knew. I was just, okay, I'm here to chant. And I had no idea what it was that I was actually praying about. I had no idea the spiritual significance of what they were inviting me to do. Therefore, it was hollow, and it was easy for me to take what for some people is a revolutionary way of life and me just to throw it in the closet and say, this is a load of crap. That was not about anything that I was doing. It was about my lack of understanding of what we were doing. And so when they say that as long as I express the idea in this third step, I can do it any way I like. Let's look at what the idea is. Because if I can change the word of this prayer to work for me rather than something that I can't take as just as written, if I understand what the prayer is about, then maybe I can word it in a way where it means something to me and I can actually connect with it, and maybe I'll be able to actually grow this relationship and really get on board. And so I want to look at it really quick. The first sentence, it's like three parts, right? There's three sentences. I look at it as three parts. It says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. So the first sentence, as I understand it, is like, as some people say, it's like waving the white flag. It's the formal terms of surrender. God, I offer myself to you. So if I can't play God in my life and you've got to be the director, like I understand, this has got to be your deal. Some people say, you know, my life is none of my business. I didn't understand that at first. But what I think we're saying here is I need to get to the place where I'm saying, I don't seem to have the best ideas. Sometimes my ideas are really terrible. So God, I'm here to do your work. But what I'm asking, you know, what I'm offering myself to God about is not so that I can get what I want. It says, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. So part of my offering is, it's like if you ever see the potter. They have the spinning wheel, you put the clay on it, and they start spinning it. And God is like the guiding hand of the potter, molding the clay into whatever vessel it is that we're trying to make it, right? So I need to be the clay. I need to be able to be molded by God. So what do you need me to do? I'm willing to get on board and say, this is your deal, so that you can build me up and use me how you need to use me. The next sentence says, now I make a request. I think part of prayer is petition, right? I'm going to God and I'm asking for something. So now I say, relieve me of the bondage of self, which is what I was talking about, of being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. You know, that's the bondage of self. If I'm constantly resentful, if I'm jealous, if I've got a bunch of lust or money, all these other things in my life that are going on, that's the bondage of self. You know, we show up here in immense bondage of self. And then as we stay sober, we continually find ourselves in the bondage of self. Because this thing just keeps going like a merry-go-round or something. It just keeps showing back up in my life, and I have to keep surrendering more and more. But so I'm asking, relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do thy will. Right? I'm not asking for you to relieve me of this selfishness so I can go out and, again, be the guy that I want to be. I'm saying relieve me of the bondage of self, because if I'm stuck in the bondage of self, there's no way I'm going to be able to do whatever it is you need me to do. I will not be able to go and live the life that I'm meant to live if I'm stuck in the driver's seat here. So I got to be willing to get out of the way and take the humility to say, can you relieve this stuff so I can maybe go out and be the guy you intended me to be. And the last one is where the hooks come in. And I didn't see this for a while. It says, take away my difficulties. So what kind of difficulties do we have? Maybe we got money problems. Maybe we got food problems. Maybe we got, you know, relationship issues. Maybe we can't hold down a job. Like whatever problems we might have, I'm saying take away my difficulties. You know? And that could also be on a spiritual level. Take away my difficulties. I always feel like I'm broken and less than. I always feel like I'm not able to live in this world with any kind of meaning and purpose. That's a difficulty. If I constantly look out at everybody else and I think I'm less than you, that's a difficulty. And so please take away my difficulties. Why? That victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And then the last sentence is, may I do thy will always. What I come to understand today is in my third step, I'm making a decision to put God in the center of my life. I'm going to make a decision to try to seek God and what I'm needed to be and needed to do on any given day. And the reason for that is that, you know, the question that I guess was offered to my first sponsor, because Bart didn't believe in any of this, or my current sponsor, Bart didn't really believe in any of this. This guy, Eric, looks at me and goes, he asks the prayer. He goes through this with him. And Bart goes, "You mean if this God I don't believe in does all this stuff I don't think is going to happen, will I go tell somebody else?" And Eric goes, "Yeah." And Bart just said, "You bet your ass." In this prayer, I'm signing up to help others. If these things are, if that bondage of self is taken away, if my difficulties are removed, am I willing to go and bear witness? Which would mean to go and be the example of God's power, God's love, and God's way of life to others. It's baked right here in my third step decision that I'm going to sign up to try to go live differently in the world and help others. I didn't see it for a long time, but to me that's everything. You know, if this stuff happens, am I willing to go and try to share with somebody else what has happened to me? So, understanding that this third step prayer is, all right, man, I need some help. I don't seem to know what you need me to do. But if you are willing to remove whatever blocks me from being the man that you need me to be, you'll give me the words you need me to say, you'll give me the strength to live how you need me to live, I'm willing to show up for you. You know. And what I'm going to try to do is go out there, and if I'm lucky, I'll get to bear witness of what has happened in my life. The change that happened from a guy that was blacking out every night, that was suicidal, that wanted to kill himself and others, hated everybody around him, judged everybody around him, has been brought to a completely different person. And the only way that happened was because I got on board with this program, and I actually tried to practice this idea of I'm not God in my life, right? So I didn't understand that there was that much to the prayer. I didn't understand, you know, again, it's easy for us to say, are you willing to make a decision to do the rest of the steps? And in the beginning, first time around, that's kind of all you need to do. You know, how? And then there's the, you know, I think we might have talked about the analogy of the three frogs on the log. One makes a decision, you know, one decided to jump. How many frogs are on the log? Well, three until the one jumps, right? So technically, I think the decision that I make here to live different isn't realized unless I'm actively making this house cleaning effort of our fourth step through our ninth step. Until I'm actively writing inventory and having a prayer life and having some meditation and maybe going to a home group and taking on a job and doing some service and making this really the priority so that I can be molded so I can be useful to somebody else, I don't think I've really made that decision. It's just like, how many times have we decided to work out or change our diet, and how often has that really happened? You know. So if I make a decision here, this thing says, if we're open to it, we're going to feel something. So I would offer that if you're questioning, am I ready to make this? You'll know when you are really ready to surrender, because something, it might even be just a little shift, but something will feel a little bit different. And so I think it's really important that we actually understand that if I'm going to make a beginning in this program, the first three steps, while they're pretty simple in the sense of I need to understand the problem, I need to understand the solution, am I into it? There's also a depth to it. And I want to read something out of the 12 and 12. Don't shoot me. my sponsor is not a fan. I love this book, but just know there's no directions in here. You know, if I need to learn how to do the steps and how to live this program, it's in the big book. This is one man's take about 15 years in writing some essays about his experience sober. But one of the things he says here is, sobriety brought about by the admission of alcoholism and by attendance at a few meetings is very good indeed. But it is bound to be a far cry from permanent sobriety and a contented, useful life. This is just where the remaining steps of the AA program come in. Nothing short of continuous action upon these as a way of life can bring the much desired result. All of the 12 steps require sustained and personal exertion to conform to their principles, and so we trust to God's will. Our whole trouble has been the misuse of willpower. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps. And the third step is what opens that door. Now, when I think of it in that way, there's a lot of depth there. But there's also a lot of direction which shows that I have to live this as a way of life. That I have to put a lot of effort into actively seeking this answer or solution. And I'll just offer at the bottom of page 63, if I'm open to this, right? Some people, I mean, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been to some meetings and I hear some funny stuff. And again, my great-grand sponsor would hold this book up and he would say, "This is my bullshit sifter." Excuse my language. But I've been told to like get into this book, understand what's in here, and then when I'm out in the fellowship, I can hear when someone's sharing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous or their ideas about Alcoholics Anonymous. And their ideas might be wonderful, and it might really work for them, and it could work for me too. But it may not work for everybody in the room. And so far, if I'm staying on this message, it seems to work for everybody who's willing to go after it. And just as the book qualifies when I'm at a third step, if I can admit in the affirmative to those three ideas, I'm at a third step. If I'm willing to take this prayer and take this action, there's a whole... the next sentence says, "Next we launched on a course of vigorous action." And so these first three steps are kind of about some self-reflection. Taking a look at what alcoholism is, what the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous brings to the table is. And then circling around the idea that, hey man, you're probably the problem. And if I'm willing to admit that I'm the problem, that I have a mind that can't leave it alone, I have a body that can't deal with it, and I don't have the ability or the power to fix that, and I'm open to trying this solution, this thing says we launch on a course of vigorous action. And the house cleaning bit that I guess we'll end up talking about next week is really our fourth step through our ninth step. And spoiler alert, the 10th and the 11th step say, now that you understand how to write this inventory, live this every day. Like, this is the one day at a time living. Am I willing to look at my resentments, my fear, my dishonesty, my selfishness? Am I willing to ask God for help? Am I willing to tell people about what's going on and inventory and be open about it? And then am I willing to go and accept my responsibility if I've done something wrong in the world? Am I willing to offer restitution to the harms where I've actually been wrong and caused damage in your life? You know, that's where we kind of stray from some of the major religions. You know, confession is not a new idea. That's been around for forever. But if you go and confess in like a Catholic church, you sit with the priest, you're in the thing, they usually say, well, like, go say a bunch of Hail Marys and, you know, some Our Fathers and you're good. But in AA, we say, that's great, keep praying, but you got to go to those people. Like, you stole $2,000 from Bob, you got to go make that right, dude. You know, and that's where some of the men of religion look at us and they go, wow, this is really drastic. I mean, you guys actually go to the people that you've harmed and address that. To me, that's really cool. And I think part of making my decision to understand if I'm going to get involved in this, I need to understand that not only am I going to look at me. You know, our fourth and fifth step, which we'll talk about next week, they talk about me looking inward and inventorying, you know, my resentments, my fear, my conduct in relationships with others of an intimate nature. You know, I got to look at my behavior there, not yours, but mine. And I got to see what's the pattern here. How have I been stepping on my own toes? And then once we get that information, we have a sixth and a seventh step, which says, you know, now we go to God and we ask for some help. You know, are you willing to have God come in and work on your pride or your fear or your selfishness or that self-pity or those belief systems where you walk around and say, I'm not good enough and I'm less than, and if they knew me, they wouldn't like me. Am I willing to invite God into those areas of my life? What about the finance? What about the romance? You know, am I willing to say, all right, this is a total solution, and God, I need you in all areas of my life. And then we have this sixth and seventh step practice that is every day, all day, if you ask me. And then we get into the eight and nine stuff where it's like, now I got to look at the damage. Like, what's the bill? What's the monetary, spiritual, emotional bill of the damage that I've caused out in the world? Let me get this down and let me look at it and go, am I willing to address that? And our program suggests that we go out and we address that the best we can. And luckily we have people that have experienced and done almost anything you could ever possibly imagine. And one of the things we don't do is just run out like crazy people and try to make amends to everybody all at once. But we sit down and there's situations that might involve conversations and we need other experience. And, you know, there's criminal stuff or there's some stuff where people, you know, we gotta get some other guidance and find some people that have had a similar experience to find out how to handle a situation. But our job is, you know, am I willing to do that? And then we go out and we actually try to do that. And then we try to live that every day. And so if I'm going to make a decision to get involved in AA, I think that I should understand that there's a totality of this, and that's what it's going to look like. And really, like as I mentioned with that bearing witness part, part of what we sign up for here is that if this stuff does work, if I do have that individualized experience of what we call spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, I start to have some kind of power that's available to me, will I make it my business to go sit down and show somebody else what was freely given to me? I came here as a drunk, as a junkie. I didn't know how to stop. You guys gave me your time. I got given a gift and I didn't have to pay a single cent for it. I'll do anything I could ever do to help somebody who's willing to do this stuff. But I know today that if you don't show up, there's nothing I can do. But if you do show up, I have to try. And I'm willing to do that today. And I'll just end with, over yesterday morning I woke up and one of my guys that's got about 3 years sober and changed now sent me a photo of him, his dog, and his now fiance, and she's going like this with the ring on in Central Park yesterday. And I got to watch this kid who couldn't stop, who hated everybody, who had all sorts of anger stuff going on. And I've gotten to watch him rebuild, you know, he sent me photos of him and his mom. And it was her birthday, and he went up and they did a thing that they used to go to this mall in Connecticut somewhere and go on rides as a kid. And it's a photo of him and his mom smiling, and she wouldn't even answer the phone when he got sober. She didn't want to have anything to do with him. And as a result of this program, you guys have given me the ability to watch that happen for other people. And that's what I think this is all about. It's like, I get well, but I really get well when I get to see this thing working for you guys. And so part of that third step for me is like, am I willing to go the distance and try to give what was given to me out? You know, yeah, you bet your ass. on that, we got some time, and I'd love to be able to put it to you guys for a couple minutes. But again, you know, I don't really know where these things are going to go. I stopped planning this stuff a while ago because whenever I tried to think about what I was going to do, it went terrible. But I really appreciate your attention, and I can feel you guys listening. You know, and so you guys are as much a part of this conversation, even though it might seem like a monologue. I think where it's going is based on the language that I, you know, I hear you guys giving me your body language, and you guys are kind of drawing this stuff out. So I really appreciate your attention, and I love you guys.